Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I asked the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
Yeah, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello and welcome to Democracy Sausage, bringing you a hearty serving of politics and public affairs twice weekly. I'm Martin Pierce, and I am temporarily tending to the podcast barbecue today with Mark Kenny unavailable. We're produced by Policy Forum at Crawford School of Public Policy, and we do so in partnership with the ANU Australian Studies Institute. Now, today we've got something a bit special for you. This is no standard bulk buy, mystery meat, supermarket snag, but something premium grade from the deli, lightly spiced with paprika and cayenne. And if that metaphor sounds a bit overcooked, hopefully today's episode won't be. Over the last few weeks, we've taken a look back at some of our favourite moments on the podcast since we began in April last year. And given the year we've had, that really feels like a lifetime ago. But over the last 18 months or so, we've had an incredible lineup of experts drawn from academia, journalism, and public affairs. Like any barbecue, it's much better in good company. So from analysis of last year's federal election campaign to the coronavirus crisis and everything in between, today we'd like to share with you our Democracy Sausage The Best Bits compilation. First up, we go way back to May 2019. It was right after Scott Morrison's miracle win. It feels like a lifetime ago now, given everything that has unfolded since. In this episode, Mark spoke with Sky News chief political reporter Kieran Gilbert and regular guest Dr. Maria Taflaga about the election result that very few people saw coming. And the panel discussed the now PM's fight to the finish, his self-belief, and whether or not Bill Shorten and the Labor Party's caution led them to electoral disaster.
I think as well, a potent part of his message, and it might have sounded hoaxy, it was a bit cheesy, you have a go, you get a go, that sort of message. But it's potent because it targets the, you know, traditional Howard Butler, the aspirational voter that Labor did not have a message for. They did not have a message for them.
Yeah, these are what they call in America the Reagan Democrats almost, yeah. You know, well, those sort of people who are working class but who are able to be dragged across to the conservative side because they have aspirations.
They have aspirations. And already Anthony Albanese has said, we need a message on how we grow the economy, not just share it. That was his opening pitch for the leadership. And I think that this was, you know, in hindsight, it was a looming vulnerability for them. And Morrison filled that gap by targeting those voters, or as he put it explicitly in his victory speech, the quiet Australians who are going about their work day by day. But essentially what they are is that aspirational class. And he's right across the country, I think that's a message that has resonated. He's a better communicator, and he was disciplined in terms of keeping that message.
It's interesting. I was listening intently to Arthur Sinodinos, obviously a great Liberal Party strategist, one of the really wise heads on the government side. He was fronting the ABC's election night broadcast for the government, and he made a couple of interesting observations. One of them was about Scott Morrison, and he said that the thing is, from the moment Morrison took over, even before that, but from the moment Morrison took over the leadership, Sinodinos was noting that he believed, that is, Morrison believed he could do it. So belief, and I'm not talking about his faith, which we can also talk about, but just this inordinate sort of unshakable belief that Scott Morrison had that he could prosecute an argument and win that argument just, you know, with sheer sort of force of will. It does seem to have been the key dynamic in this election campaign.
It's a key characteristic of, prime ministerial aspirants. And if you talk to anyone who's ever worked with Bill Shorten, you'll get a sense that he had a similar belief, but perhaps not in this campaign. Or he just simply went quite awry.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Do you think Bill Shorten kind of went missing? Everyone talks about the fact that he the assessment, and I certainly held this view at the time, the assessment in the first couple of weeks of the campaign, he really did seem quite cautious. He was in this odd position of being the opposition leader, defending himself rather than attacking, you know, to try and take government. There was a sort of a reversal of roles there. And so, yes, that belief question is interesting. I think he did have this long-term belief that he would one day be prime minister, much like Malcolm Turnbull.
I think that belief, actually, having watched him closely in this campaign, I think it went all the way up till Saturday. I think he believed he was going to win.
Yeah.
Well, I think he believed he was going to win, but
My
point isn't so – I guess that's right, but what I'm getting at is that there was some cautiousness there on the part of Labor in the campaign. Labor had a bold agenda, and everyone talks about the sort of political courage of its agenda. Completely understandable, that argument. But in terms of the campaign itself, once it was up and running, I thought there was a sort of a tremulousness in the way it put forward its position.
Well, absolutely. He was reticent to do debates. He didn't do the press club in the final week. He was cautious. And I think maybe it was playing safe because they thought they were going to win. But little did they know, their polling, internal and published, were wrong. He misjudged the character, I think, of Australia, basically, with his message.
Whereas Morrison came in like a middle-order batsman in a match where they were unlikely to overhaul the total
and
just started playing his shots. Yeah. I mean, there was a freedom in his, you know, as a batsman, you know, he freed his shoulders
he had nothing to lose.
Yes.
It was in Northern Tasmania the final day on Saturday. He was campaigning to the last minute.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's really telling. In fact, if you look at what he did in those last few hours, the hours that everyone thought had been obliterated by the grief and shock of the death of Bob Hawke on that Thursday night in the last week, you know, Morrison, as you say, he was in Northern Tasmania on polling day, you know, so I think he was the first prime minister to be in Tasmania on election day since Joseph Lyons, who happened to be a Tasmanian.
Yeah.
So that kind of should have told people that there had this something happening there. They think these two Labor seats in Northern Tasmania are gettable. He was also in Longman, I think, on the day before, on the Friday. And Longman, of course, is another Liberal gain in this election. So, yeah, amazing self-belief and amazing surgical focus, almost like this guy handled this like a marketing exercise. He worked out where his markets were. He targeted his messages very, very carefully, and then he just hammered them.
Shorten was so convinced that he had the right template that he convinced himself, and he said so many times that the times suit us. He said that a lot. The times suit me, you know, but they didn't, because he put all his eggs in the basket of trying to help those on the lowest and middle, you know, the lowest part of the income range, but not recognizing that as you nudge, you know, most of those people want to be doing better as well. So I just think they lost that message of opportunity, which they could have incorporated into their fairness agenda.
I think they became a bit complacent in a way. And it sort of shows in what Tanya Plibersek afterwards said. She sort of said, well, we wanted we didn't want to get down in the mud, and we wanted to sort of, you know, have the moral high ground and campaign on our agenda. But what they sort of failed to do was to constantly remind voters during this campaign what a troubled government this has been.
Exactly.
You know, it's a government that not only has changed its leader several times, but has lost control of the parliament. We're so afraid of coming back to parliament that they only sat for a handful of days this year, so they haven't been really doing their jobs. Mm. And then when parliament did come back, they actually lost control of their own agenda and had legislation forced upon them. And not to mention the fact that all the underlying structural problems within this government before the Morrison win remained, right? No. They cannot agree on climate change. They cannot agree on other policy directions.
They've got no energy policy at all. They couldn't even agree on that.
And there's a litany of sort of, you know, like favours for mates stories. And perhaps what Labor really needed to do, the negative portion of their campaign, was not necessarily to run a character assassination upon Scott Morrison or, you know, to make up a Medicare scare or so on and so forth, but just to remind voters that this government has not done a good job of serving citizens. It's done a very good job of concerning itself with its own internal wrangle.
It shouldn't have been close. To be honest, because everything you've said is right, it should not have been close. And Labor's advertising wasn't as good. The government was
they
much
did,
more
they
effective.
They did run a fair few pictures of Peter Dutton through Victoria. They didn't get a single thing in Victoria that wasn't already penciled into their column after the election. You know, they didn't get a single seat that wasn't already penciled from the redistribution.
I don't think their ads and certainly the unions, it was nowhere near as potent as the bill you can't afford. That was the best ad of the campaign, and quite clearly, you know, it was enough to contribute to this victory.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's easy to be sort of wise in hindsight, I guess, but I find it much easier than actually predicting. I mean, I'll say it again, I predicted that Labor would win this election because of all of the fundamentals, Maria, that you just talked about. And one of the other ones you didn't even mention was, you know, their women problem, the fact that prominent women were walking away in droves, you know.
Standing as independents.
Yeah.
And they took a seat from Tony Abbott.
Yeah, exactly, or just simply giving up.
We return to the end of 2019 in the next clip, where we revisit our conversation with veteran journalist and now ABC Insider's host, David Spears. In this segment, David reflects on his role in developing Australia's 24-hour news industry in his time at Sky News. He discusses the initial resistance the channel received from the offices of the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, who were reticent to have backbenchers stray from the talking points of the day, and the enormous change that this has brought about in Australian politics. Let's give it a listen.
It's quite a different process, I suppose, or demands on you than you've been used to. I mean, one of the things about what you've done at Sky has been to be there through the whole development of this idea of the 24-hour news channel or the constant news channel, and you've really pioneered that. What do you think has been the major shift that you've seen over that 20 years in terms of the way politics is done and mediated, I suppose, to the people?
It's been an enormous change. When I started at Sky, we started up a bureau in Parliament House, and it was just me, and there'd never been 24-hour news channel coverage of Australian politics before. We'd seen CNN, we'd seen, you know, Fox News had been there for a little bit, and B Sky in London as well with a 24-hour news channel. So we had a few ideas, but in many ways, politics in Washington and London are far more dramatic than what's happening here. So it was a very different thing to try and make Australian politics interesting hour after hour in an Australian context, and not always easy. But, you know, we started with a few ideas, but really it was about making it up as we went along, feeling our way, what worked, what didn't.
And being serious about politics, like being totally dedicated to politics.
That's right. And treating our audience like viewers who wanted to know more about politics, weren't just watching the 6 o'clock network news where the politics story might be, you know, halfway down the bulletin. These were people engaged and interested in politics, and we wanted to treat them with respect and seriously. So, yeah, we covered it in a lot of detail, a lot of depth, you know, at times, and, you know, sitting there in the studio with me many, many times over the years, you can get right down the rabbit hole on some issues. But the audience for that, you know, news channel purpose like that. They're interested. They're into that. So it was a different type of journalism. So that changed, I think, a lot of the way the political process started. It took a while, but you know, when we started to get backbenchers coming on for panel discussions, I mean, you see it everywhere now, but I can tell you back when we started doing this, we copped a lot of resistance from the Prime Minister's office and the opposition leader's office in particular. They didn't want these backbenchers getting on television and saying the wrong thing, saying something that was slightly off what the talking points of the day were, and there was great risk they saw in doing that for very little reward because there was such a small audience. So we got a lot of resistance from that.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
You know, a lot of MPs got pulled and told, don't go and sit in the Sky studio. Eventually things changed. They all understood this is an important part of the conversation now and a good way for politicians to get the message out in from a number of different faces in a number of different ways. Sure, they don't always agree, but I think that's been a really good thing for transparency, for opening up debate. And as I say, since then we've got the ABC News channel. We've got lots of panel shows everywhere doing this now.
David Spears there. That was a terrific discussion. Now, moving from the world of journalism to the academy, in this next clip, we hear from Nobel laureate and Vice Chancellor of here at the Australian National University, Professor Brian Schmidt. Recorded in March this year in the wake of Australia's devastating bushfire crisis, Professor Schmidt discusses his weariness with non-experts throwing up, as he describes it, crap science in the climate debate.
When you were asked about this on AM by my friend Sabra Lane, I remember one word particularly that came out of your mouth quite early in the answer, which is that you said you were weary about the you know, the debate on climate change around the science and so forth. How frustrating has that been? And as a follow up to that, there seems to be a shift going on now, a pivot towards the sort of technology you've just been talking about. In the end, is all this sort of debate going to get overtaken by technological advances?
So I'm weary because we're continuing to go over the same old crap, and a lot of it's just crap. And I don't mind, and indeed I insist upon people who are experts coming in and questioning our understanding. That is part of science, and that is a great thing to occur, expert to expert, and that's how science works. The weariness comes from people who are not experts continuing throwing up crap science in public and just, you know, creating a distraction, red herrings to the real debate. In the end, science is never black and white. It's always about probabilities. And, you know, there's the probabilities that we have a 4 or 5 degree warming of the planet coming up and the impacts that cause. And, you know, when I multiply those things out, we need to be working really fast at mitigating that risk as fast as we can. Technology is a really important aspect to that, but it's not just technology. We have to build up resilience for the change that's already coming, and that means being able to adapt. And you don't – adaption is not sufficient on itself, but we're going to have to do that because the change is coming and it's coming fast. At the same time, we do need to create new technologies, but we also have to just change our behaviors and get people thinking about this through every aspect of our planning within society. It's just such a huge thing. It needs to be integrated into our thinking on a day-to-day basis of everything that our society does. Because if we get this wrong, it really is going to be catastrophic.
Plenty of food for thought there. Now, moving into this year, in August, Mark sat down with demographer at the Australian National University, Dr. Liz Allen. In the episode, The Future of Us, they discussed her book of the same name and what demography tells us about Australian society. It was a brilliant discussion, really entertaining and very informative. And in this clip, they discuss the myth of a classless Australia. And Liz shares some of her own personal experience as a self-described former poor kid.
So take, for example, something I'm keenly interested in, given my own particular background as a single point of demography, is this idea that we know from the literature that and from previous research that there's very little social mobility. That is, that the circumstances of your birth, the circumstances of your parents, the socioeconomic circumstances of your parents, determines much of your life, the trajectory of your life course, your level of education, your income, your social standing. And that to me is quite jarring, this idea, you know, we hear demography is destiny. At an individual level, we certainly see that to some degree. And I think in Australia, we like to think we're fair and that people, if you have a go, you get a go and you'll be right, mate.
We like to think we're fair and we also like to think we're sort of classless.
And it's not true. And it's not true. And that's something that I think as a former poor kid who has, you know, experienced disadvantage.
But who now has a PhD. So in a sense, you buck that trend.
I'm a deviant. I am a deviant. I'm one of and it's actually known. It's known as a deviant case, one that's dropped out and gone against the grain. That carries some responsibility, right? Mm. That I speak for those that are left behind. But here's the thing about poverty and disadvantage is that it never leaves you. So I'm also a teen mum. I'm no longer a teen, but I still say I'm a teen mum. Why? Because there are epigenetic factors that come with those experiences early in life and even before your birth that influence you as a kind of genetic person in space. And it changes the way that your brain processes, kind of the cognitive processes of scarcity. So there's, you know, there's a saying that, and a belief certainly that poor people are dumb when it comes to money. Poor people aren't dumb when it comes to money. Again, research shows that what happens is when you're faced with scarcity, your cognitive processes change because you're so caught up in trying to survive that you don't focus on or you cannot focus on outward looking and that stays with you.
Because those outward looking things are much more abstract. They're far less tangible. The idea of an overseas holiday or a new car next year or of saving for your retirement or whatever, these are quite secondary to a much more hand-to-mouth existence. And so in a sense, they're quite abstract.
You may not get to retirement.
Precisely.
Right? And that's the thing is that when you're surviving and you're thinking about how am I going to live today, tomorrow, or feed my kids, you're not thinking about a holiday because odds are you ain't getting one.
No. You don't really imagine it.
No, because it's not a possibility you're talking about. Mm. The fundamental of survival.
That was a great discussion. Do check that one out if you haven't listened to us. It's called The Future of Us. Now, let's move from Australia to global issues because as the Black Lives Matter protests erupted globally, on Democracy Sausage, we examined Australia's own shameful past on the episode You Stand on a Plinth of Lies. In June this year, Indigenous Australian journalist Stan Grant joined us on Democracy Sausage, where he discussed how Indigenous people speaking truth to power is often seen as an assault on history. In this powerful clip, he asks why police are sent to guard statues, but Indigenous heritage sites are legally blown up by mining companies. Let's have a listen.
I think the point's been made really well here, and that is that statues are not history. You know, statues are a representation of who we were and who we are. And the difficulty for us in trying to have this conversation, it's if we raise it, and I'm speaking here as an Indigenous Australian, if we raise it, we are seen as somehow attacking the state, that our truth is seen as an historical war, a war on history. We have the Prime Minister using that language. I don't want to engage in a history war. When our truth, when our attempt to try to speak to this power is categorized as an attack, as a war, when it is weaponized, it makes it so much more difficult to do as Paul was describing there, to approach this in a democratic way. I mean, you know, I thought very gently 3 years ago at the height of the Confederate statue issue in the United States, the question of the Cook statue in Hyde Park, which still proclaims that he discovered this territory in 1770. Our High Court doesn't believe that. Our laws don't represent that. Our welcomes to country tell us that is not true. But a statue that stands above us all in our biggest city still proclaims this as fact. In even suggesting that we might revisit that, that we might even look at an ancillary plaque or some way of representing that that view is now redundant. I had the Prime Minister at the time, Malcolm Turnbull, accuse me of being a Stalinist. I had the Daily Telegraph describe me as Taliban Stan. I mean, to even broach this subject, we are seen as attacking the state. We saw the image over the past week of a ring of police standing around this inanimate object, around the Cook statue, which at worst is vandalized and you can clean it. Standing around that while we've had Indigenous sites, heritage sites blown up by Rio Tinto in Western Australia. And that should tell us everything about what we value, that we will ring a statue with police and our law will allow for a mining company to destroy our heritage. That's what speaks to the reality of power still in Australia.
Stan Grant there with a powerful message. Now, Jim Chalmers is Shadow Treasurer. He's an economist, and he's the person that many are tipping as a future Labor leader. At the end of April this year, in the wake of Australia's first wave of COVID-19 cases, he discussed why Australians are frightened for their futures after the crisis and why the country needs to go beyond the partisan politics to address it. Let's have a listen to what Jim had to say.
It's not the most important thing, but one of the galling things about this is, you know, you would have seen on Four Corners the other night when David Spears did that show about the government's response. You know, all the same characters who have been deriding government intervention in the economy, saying that stimulus is a farce, you know, saying that there was some kind of debt and deficit disaster. There they all lined up to take credit for the decisions taken during this period. And I think that's as good an illustration of any that history is casting its own verdict on how they behaved then in 2009 and how they've behaved since. And the most important thing is that they, you know, they have learned some kind of lesson. We welcome the fact that they've had a change of heart. Clearly, when economies are in crisis and people's, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Australians' jobs are threatened, then that calls for governments to contemplate things that they wouldn't contemplate in normal times. That's the lesson of the GFC. That's the lesson from now as well. I think the main thing that, well, one of the other considerations that, as well, is if they've learned the lesson of 2009, we want to make sure that they've learned the lesson of 2014 as well. And you would have covered that first horror budget of this, the then Abbott-Hockey government. And what they did then was they managed coming out of the crisis badly by asking the most vulnerable people in the community to carry a disproportionate load when it came to paying the debt back. So we hope that they've learned from that as well and not just from the earlier period. Absolutely. People in tears, you know, and so they're petrified. But the other thing about that is that's the near-term fear that they have, but they're also really frightened about what the future looks like. And they don't want the story of the future Australia, which is written after this crisis subsides, they don't want to be written out of that story. They're frightened about whether they fit in the economy that exists after this crisis. They know it's been a big reset. They know that all of the old certainties have sort of, in one way or another, been blown up. And so the worried conversations they have in hushed tones after the kids go to bed are about what does the future look like for them? And they've got commitments. Household debt was already at record highs before the crisis hit. They've got all kinds of commitments. And so I think one of the reasons why the onus is on us to come back to some of those earlier questions, to be responsible and constructive, and why the onus is on Scott Morrison to be more inclusive and to seek consensus more genuinely and to involve the states, is because this isn't actually in the end about a political contest. It's about what the story of Australia is after that and whether, you know, real people and real communities are written into that story. And right now, if you talk to enough people, there is enough fear that they're going to miss out, that there's going to be a generation of people who miss out after this. And that's the most important thing we have to focus on.
What do you think is the, within that framework of focusing on that, what do you think is the key to that? I mean, wages, for example, obviously jobs are important. Going back to the point about changing the consultation time for EBAs, I mean, the logic of that was a lot of industries are facing, a lot of employers are facing dramatically reduced demand and difficult circumstances, and so might need to make quite quick adjustments to, you know, to their operations. You know, that's kind of understandable at one level. But what do you think looking forward is the key to the recovery? Is it to do something about stagnant wages? And if it is, what is that thing? Well, you know, how do we unlock wages growth, for example?
Well, the most important thing is you keep as many people attached, you know, in the time being, because that impacts on how you recover out of this. You know, you would know from the early 90s recession that a lot of people who lost their jobs then didn't find their way back in the labour market, particularly older male workers. That was a massive, massive problem. And so it matters what we do now to that challenge, to what the recovery looks like.
Now, in our last clip, before we take a quick break, we stay with the Australian government's coronavirus response. What is it that drives government decisions about what policies get funding and what don't? Many would say that it's ideology, but as economist Richard Dennis explained to us, there is a big difference between ideology and interests, and very often it's the latter driving choices in so many crucial policy areas.
Yes, absolutely. Now, Maria, I don't want to beat up on the government unnecessarily or talk our own book as people employed in the education sector, but going to the point that both you and Richard are making here, which is about the role of ideology in a lot of these decisions. I mean, it does feel like there's some fairly strong ideology in the decision initially not to include the university sector in the major protection programs that they've run for this COVID crisis. And then, so at the top end of the education cycle, the university sector, and at the bottom end of the education cycle, the even more important early childhood education sector is having that assistance withdrawn rather early. Yet we still see quite substantial subsidisation of particularly the private school sector in this country. So there's a lot of ideology here, isn't there?
Oh, look, I don't think there's ideology at all, Mark. I think it's just interests. ideology refers to – no, it's a big difference. Ideology refers to a consistent set of ideas. And ideology shouldn't be a dirty word. People should have consistency in their sets of ideas. So let's break that down. As I said before, you know, the government loves to subsidise some forms of energy, brackets fossil fuel. They don't like to subsidise other forms of energy, such as renewables. They love to subsidise some forms of education, like private schools. They don't like to subsidise other forms of education, like public universities. They made JobKeeper available, by the way, to the privately owned universities. Gladys Berejiklian, often criticised for being sort of a zealot when it comes to privatisation, literally spent $1 billion of taxpayers' money to buy a football stadium so she could knock it down and build a new one. There is no ideology at play here whatsoever. There is just interests. There are just preferences. There are just desires. And I actually think we flatter people unfairly when we call them ideologues. Again, it's hard to be an ideologue. It's hard to be consistent. It's hard to keep standing up for one side of the argument. It's actually very easy just to always give money to your friends and to always hold it back from your opponents. So, yeah, there's some clear patterns here. But they're not patterns around the size of government. They're not patterns around the role of regulation. They're just patterns of who are the preferred groups that typically get cash and who are the preferred groups that don't.
It's a really thought-provoking discussion with Richard Dennis there. Do give that one a listen. So let's take a quick break there, but we'll be back with you in just a moment.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back to this special Democracy Sausage episode, where we are revisiting some of our favourite moments from gathering around the hot plate of politics and public affairs. In this second half, we move from the domestic to the international. First up, we start our little virtual jaunt overseas in the United Kingdom. A no-deal Brexit, which is just weeks away, would clearly have a devastating impact on Britain's economy. So why do so many UK voters seem to want it? In August last year, I spoke to the host of the then Remainiacs, it's now being renamed to Oh God, What Now? Podcast, Roz Taylor. And Roz explained why no deal will be catastrophic and why those messages aren't getting through to voters, and indeed why some Britons have, as she says, a yearning for chaos. It's a terrific interview. Let's have a listen to it. What about the European Union? I mean, he's sort of about promising a kind of can-do attitude of all about positivity and that will achieve a result. How are the EU going to respond to that? Will they also be swept up in his positivity?
No, the EU dislikes Boris Johnson and has just disliked him ever since he was a young journalist in Brussels in the 90s when he was making things up about things like, shall I say sausages? I'm pretty sure it was sausages. It was certainly bananas.
The bendy bananas.
The bendy bananas, yeah. And all kinds of things that were supposed to be affecting our national pride and sovereignty. And it has disliked him ever since then when he realised the power of the EU to that it could be the way he could deploy the European institutions in the service of populism. One of the reasons why Johnson won the leadership was because of a lot of entryism in the party. A lot of people who previously members of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which has been around since the early 90s in various forms, joined the Conservative Party specifically so that they could vote in the leadership election and get Boris Johnson. And that's one of the reasons why he triumphed. So they are not representative anymore. Having said that, they and the Brexit Party between them have managed to pull public opinion towards the acceptability of no deal, which is the real thing that has changed. I mean, I hold Theresa May partly responsible, at least for this, largely responsible, because she used to say no deal is better than a bad deal. And that was, you know, bollocks to use a British expression. But she said it quite early on, and it meant that it normalised the idea of no deal. And also, of course, there's the idea that people think there's a game show in Britain that's been around for a while, and it involves someone saying deal or no deal. And if you go for no deal, nothing changes. And so that contributed to the idea that no deal meant stasis, and it doesn't. It means chaos.
Moving on from Brexit, but staying in the UK, in May this year, we were joined by Europe correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Bevan Shields. On the episode, The NHS and a Nation on Its Knees, Bevan shared his terrifying personal account of catching COVID-19 in the UK and his experience of the much-loved National Health Service, which was being crippled at the height of the pandemic.
You were also desperately ill. Can you talk us through your own personal experience of that?
Yeah, it wasn't a fun time, and I'm glad it's over, to be honest. I'd actually started covering coronavirus when it first took hold in northern Italy, and I never really imagined – I mean, I knew there was a risk, but I never really imagined then that I could get it at some point. And I didn't get it from Italy. I ended up getting it when I was well and truly back here in London, and I'd been working hard for a good few months, really, really hard. And I just woke up one day and felt absolutely exhausted, really drained. My body was a bit sore. So I asked for a couple of days off because I just thought I was tired. I was exhausted. And then gradually over the next few days, other symptoms developed. My neck and head felt like someone had trampled all over it. And my body felt like it had been hit by baseball bats, and then the telltale fever and cough set in, and the fever in particular was horrendous. I've had the flu before and never ever had anything like this. And the cough was unbelievably persistent, and ultimately it ended up affecting my breathing. And I actually hadn't realized how bad my breathing had become until I got better, and I remembered what it felt like to not have to struggle to breathe. And there was one night in particular where I got up and was in the bathroom and had a shower and was just so exhausted by the whole thing, so struggling for air, that I slumped to the floor and was holding my chest and couldn't breathe, and was on the tiles for half an hour and had to climb back to bed literally on my hands and knees to get there. So it wasn't very fun, and I ended up having to call the ambulance. That was the advice from the NHS. They came and said, look, yes, you're sick, but your local hospital, which actually happened to be the one that Boris Johnson was in, they basically said it's very full, and we're not really sure what they might be able to do for you there. So I decided to stay home and rode it out, and luckily got better.
Yeah, that was the critical night, wasn't it, when you could have gone either way, and they were sort of saying to you that if you went there, you might end up in a corridor, and that unless you really need to go there, you might be better off staying where you are, and sort of left it in your hands, and you made that decision. I saw a message from you around that time. I think it was on Twitter, or it may have been a text message to some of your friends, of which I was one, that really, I mean, I found it very shocking, because you were the first person I knew and cared for that was affected by it, and it just sounded so worrying. And then I didn't hear anything for a few days, and that was obviously the worst part of it for you. And you live alone, right?
It was a reminder to me that as a journalist, there's a story behind each of these daily numbers that we see each day, not just the horrendous number of deaths, but the number of people who've actually got it. And it is true that the vast majority of people who get it have either mild conditions or they're asymptomatic. But there are a lot of people who in the UK who have had this, landed in hospital or had it and tried to do the right thing and not increase the pressure on the public health system and stay at home and ride it out and not had an enjoyable experience. And I think we will, when we look back at this over the next year or two, there's an increasing focus now on what, not just the official toll, but what's termed the number of excess deaths. And that's the number of deaths that are being recorded across the country at this time of year compared to the 5-year average for this time of year. And that shows that there's possibly maybe, you know, 55,000 people who have died over and above what we would normally expect for this time of year. And that figure doesn't match up with the official death figure, which is about 35,000. So there's something going on. There are a lot more people suffering, I think, than we realize.
Thanks to Bevan for sharing that story. Now, one of Ireland's best known commentators, Fintan O'Toole, joined us in mid-March for an episode which was called The Era of Existential Risk. It was a terrific and engaging and funny and thought-provoking episode. So do give it a listen if you haven't already. Now, in the episode, he discusses how neoliberalism led to a period of complacency about disease and argues that now is a time for big government and a public health focus to tackle COVID-19. He makes the case that infection has in fact defined progressive change over centuries and that COVID-19 may well do the same.
Another point, there was a suggestion that some of this was, you know, part of a plot or a hoax or whatever
yeah,
it was.
Yeah.
Yes, really very worrying.
The foreign virus is something called, you know, that it's obviously, it's a foreign virus which is attacking America. You know, it's not, nothing, yeah. You know, it's a, the nationalist narrative is being imposed on it. And I mean, I don't want to be gloomy about it, but I would be very worried if I was in the United States. I actually think the US is possibly the place. Other than very poor countries with no health systems, but, you know, in the developed world, I think it's the place I would least like to be now because you have 35 million people who have no 35 million workers who have no sick leave, as you know. You have health systems which are, you know, not designed for any kind of equality of access. You have 11 million undocumented people who are afraid to go to the doctor. And you have Trump and you have all that kind of, you know.
And you just have that completely kind of dysfunctional system, really. It's all disaggregated. There are limited scope that the federal government has in terms of ensuring all of this. You've got, as you say, just the failure of health insurance to be anything like universal like we have in this country. It's a really very kind of vulnerable situation, and a certain amount of official denial deep into this crisis has not helped.
And it's been very deep, as you say, it's you know, starting with the hoax stuff. And I remember, Trump has a record of saying, he's an anti-vaxxer, basically, you know, these vaccines are very dangerous, you know. And so this is the messaging that he's been putting out to his followers, you know, and the sort of nexus that he's in is a very anti-vaxxer sort of, you
know. Well, he might know, apparently it turns you orange. He's got well, some personal experience of what happens.
I suppose it's what this thing is showing us, isn't it? That it's shining a very brutal light on political cultures and political systems.
Indeed.
And I don't know how you think about it. It seems to me this is the end of the era of political risk that we've been in, really since the great banking crisis, where public trust in government collapsed, public trust in experts collapsed, not for for bad reasons, because a lot of the experts were telling us that, you know, everything was perfectly safe in the financial world. So it seems to me we've almost been, you could think about the 21st century so far in terms of three waves of risk. You know, there's the financial one.
Yeah.
Which then people respond to with this political risk, this willingness to take political risks, to say, well, they're all liars, they're all buffoons, there's no experts, there's no information really, it's all made up. So I'm just going to entertain myself by, you know, I'm going to vote for Trump or I'm going to vote for Brexit or, you know, all this sort of stuff. And I think that era has just finished, right? So we're into an era of existential risk, you know. And I think that will do things to people's expectations of governments and expectations of their politicians. Would you elect Donald Trump right now? You know, if you're having an election tomorrow, to say who would you think would be best to deal with this crisis? Would you elect a Boris Johnson? You know, would you elect these figures who are very entertaining and people find them amusing? But in a crisis like this, you know, is this what you want? I suspect that era has just finished. If you go back to, the high point of the neoliberal tide, you know, coming in from 1979, 1980, Thatcher, Reagan. I mean, it's probably Reagan's statements, if you remember, where he said that you know, they made the joke about the 10 most terrifying words in the English language: "I am from the government and I'm here to help."
Yes.
And that summed up brilliantly. And of course, Reagan was, you know, brilliant at putting a kind of folksy gloss on this actually right-wing anarchic hatred of government, you know. Now, I'm from the government and I'm here to help is exactly what, you know, citizens of all systems and all countries and all cultures at the moment need. You know, you realize that actually you need big government and you need it to be able to be responsive and you need it to have capacity and you need it to have a sense of equality has to be at the center of this. You know, and I think this is really going to challenge that whole idea that inequality is good and natural, because if you stand back from this What's been the great driver of progressive change over the last 200 years? It's actually been infection. You know, the biggest single thing that makes rich people think, I can't insulate myself from the poor. I'd love to, but I can't do it. Is, you know, it's the what historians call the great sanitary awakening of the 19th century. You know, clean water, plumbing systems, sanitation systems. That then leads into when you know scientific capacity comes into mass immunization, then national health services. You know, these are the things which are kind of driven progressive change. And perhaps looking back, there's a sort of weird coincidence between the rise of neoliberalism and this period of complacency we've been in, where the mass immunization starts to work. You know, and actually in most Western societies, you don't have all of these diseases. I was just thinking about this. I'm 62. My grandfather died of tuberculosis at the age of 32.
I'm glad that you remember that, or at least you remember that piece of your family history, because I noticed Donald Trump was surprised that people could die of the flu, and his own grandfather had died of the flu.
Yeah, and my mother's young sister died at 3 from diphtheria, which was, you know, and my brother died at 3 months old, you know, from a gastric infection that was in the hospital or something, you know, and we took that. I don't mean we took for granted in the sense that we thought it was okay. It was absolutely terrible. It was shocking and an appalling effects on people's lives. But I'm not that old, but I grew up in a world that was a world of airborne infection, you know, and therefore society had to be organized around that. I mean, I remember getting on the bus and there used to be a sign saying, please do not expectorate. And I was just thinking about
spit
this.
I
don't remember a time when I didn't know what expectorate meant. You know, you knew it meant spit. But even as a child, you knew, because, you know, that was the world you grew up in. There had been a polio epidemic, for example, in Ireland in the late 1950s. So, you know, I was in school. There were kids in calipers, for example, you know, with their legs which had been paralyzed by polio, which was a virus. So we lived in a world of infection, and that was terrible. But I don't want to say there was an upside to it. But what it did mean was that there was a very profound sense that disease was public. And what we've done, if you think about the kind of coincidence of the neoliberal era with what we've done with health, we've privatized health, both in terms of structures very often, privatizing systems, but also, you know, health is your responsibility. It's about your diet. It's about your exercise. And I'm not saying those things are wrong. Of course, they're not wrong, because not all disease is communicable. I mean, heart disease and cancer and all the rest of it. But the sense of public health, which has been such a driver of progressive social democratic policies or liberal policies in the American sense, over the last 200 years has been lost. And we're suddenly regaining it. I mean, health has just become public health again. I think that has very profound implications for the way in which we're going to think about government and the way we're going to think about the state and what our expectations of it are and how we organize societies.
Such a great discussion. It was a real pleasure to hear that one again. Now, Australian journalist Jonathan Swan made headlines this year for his explosive interview with then-President Donald Trump. But before that, he spoke with us about Trump's coronavirus response. He discusses Trump's obsession with polls and the stock market, why the president is so ill-equipped to deal with a public health crisis, and the moment when Trump realized COVID-19 was out of his control. Let's have a listen to that now.
There were two reasons initially why he was unwilling to listen to his advisors. Number one was he has this obsession with the stock market. It's probably the singular – I've been covering him since 2015, and I remember covering him on the campaign and going to rallies. And when you talk to Trump in that period, he was obsessed with the polls, right? And it was when he was polling particularly well. He was in the primary. It was something he could boast. He always needs a metric with which he can say, this is how good I am. This is the number that stipulates exactly how amazing I am. And when the polls stopped being good, he turned to the stock market and the Dow became his poll, and he was obsessed with it. And it colored so much of his thinking. It colored the way he thought about trade deals. It colored the way he thought about anything. And the best way to think about Trump is, and it's not an original observation, but it really is how he operates. He's a day trader. He doesn't think in the long term. He thinks about what he needs to do to get through the next minute, hour, news cycle? What can I do and say right now to get instant gratification? And of course, when people started to talk about this virus in late January, it was something that only in his mind posed one thing, which was this could really screw up my beautiful economy and my beautiful stock market if people get overly spooked about it. He genuinely didn't think it was going to come here. And in his mind, you know, putting in some travel restrictions was going to sort of hermetically seal off America. There was a period where he didn't want to let people in off one of these cruise ships because it would add to the numbers of people that were infected. And so for the longest period of time, mostly through February and early March, that was the mindset. What can we do? And then you had advisors going out saying, we've got this thing contained, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was this moment in probably around March 11th, when it dawned on him that this was out of his control, that this was not something that he could tweet away. This was not something that he could, you know, describe as fake news or use his usual toolbox. And that's been the greatest frustration for him because, frankly, there's been so many times in this presidency where commentators have said this is the mortal blow or this will undo him, whether it be the threat of his financial records coming out with Deutsche Bank or the Mueller investigation and Russia, or this is the final shoe to drop. And he's actually constitutionally pretty well set up to manage that kind of assault. But when it's something where you actually have to rely on the government, which to a large extent he's gutted, experts, bureaucrats, the scientific community, calm, measured, consistent public communication, this is not what Donald Trump does. So right now, for example, you have this situation where he has completely moved on from the public health messaging, explicitly so. He doesn't want to be out there talking about statistics or, you know, the need for social distancing. He is trying now to position himself as, in this election, the candidate who's going to reopen your economy, who's going to bring back the glory days of the economy. You know, he's out there not wearing a mask. He loves the visual contrast of him being mask-free and Joe Biden wearing a mask. And that's what he's setting up for the fall. He's trying to defy the reality of the current polling, which is that people are still very concerned about this virus. They're worried about going back out to their normal lives. And he is trying to kind of will it to be.
Jonathan Swan there. Terrific discussion. In this final clip, we move a little closer to home. China's $1 trillion Belt and Road Initiative has been a source of major controversy in Australia, with the federal government seemingly deeply concerned about Victoria's decision to sign a memorandum of understanding with China on the program. In September, I spoke with the head of the ANU Centre on China and the World, Professor Jane Golley. And in this clip, Jane argues that national security concerns about so-called debt trap diplomacy are in actual fact not supported by evidence, yet are now part of common parlance all around the world.
The number of times I've heard the Belt and Road being accused of this cunning plan for debt trap diplomacy, honestly, I would be wealthy if I'd collected a dollar each time. And I do have strong views about it that are based on what I've read widely about, including from work done here at the Crawford School. I mean, basically, the idea of debt trap diplomacy suggests that Beijing or any other government might deliberately go in and loan lots of money to another country, watch that country fall into the or find themselves unable to repay those loans, and then use that as leverage against them to make them comply with their foreign policy wishes. Now, that is possible in theory, but I just can't see it making sense in practice. I mean, the idea that you'd sink lots of money in and just watch it go down the drain, that's your money going to waste there, particularly at this point in time, you know, in post-COVID, the world economy is crumbling, China's own foreign reserves are falling rapidly. Like, it's really important for them to make investments that are actually going to benefit their own investors, but also the motivation for, you know, it's such an indirect route, I think, for them to gain power that it doesn't matter. But the reason I think that most strongly? Is it the evidence that I've read, and I've read about it in the African context, in Latin America, and in the Pacific? Very often we hear reference to the Hambantota port. Isn't this a classic example? Well, actually, if you look at the facts closely there, and we've got, again, colleagues here at the ANU who have done that, there really isn't that much evidence, or I'd go as far as saying any evidence that Beijing has deliberately done that. You know, maybe one or two tiny examples where it might play out a little bit. But overall, there isn't the evidence to suggest that Beijing has engaged in debt trap diplomacy. And yet now it's used as kind of common knowledge and common parlance in describing the Belt and Road.
My thanks to Jane and all of the guests and speakers that we have featured on today's podcast. Because with that, that brings our special Best of Democracy Sausage episode to a close. But before I let you go, don't forget to subscribe to Democracy Sausage. We're on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you normally get your favourite podcasts from. And if you're feeling particularly satisfied with your regular helpings of Democracy Sausage, we'd love for you to leave us a review. We always love hearing your thoughts on the show. Finally, if you want to continue the discussion about this episode or any of our episodes, join the Pod Squad on Facebook. Type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar on Facebook and you can chat directly with the pod team, plus our community of listeners. We can't wait to see you there. We'll be back on Monday with our regular episode of Democracy Sausage. But until then, from me, cheerio.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.